Zedekiah is who we'll be talking about today with regards to that. I don't know, my voice is very deep today because of sinuses, so I apologize for how I sound. If I get choked up, it's not because of the lesson, it's just because of sinus drainage. But I had the privilege of going to Washington this couple weeks ago, and you know, it's pretty amazing. I've never been up there to see the Capitol in D.C. and being able to walk through, and was only up there a couple days, and I think that's probably what started the sinus stuff. But very impressive city with regards to the history piece of it, and was sent up there to go to Congress and talk with a couple of the senators. So very, very interesting time with regards to being able to meet with them and seeing some of our politicians at first hand and knocking on the doors and being able to talk with them individually. But very interesting. That'll certainly be a highlight for us as a family to go to, if you haven't done that, is to get up there to see the different parts of the Washington, D.C. piece. Harking, well, Uber is a wonderful thing. So, you know, that's the beauty of I guess, the newness of that, or a taxi. We took an Uber from the airport to the hotel and didn't, and everything else was walked upon. So. And then a taxi back to the airport. So, yeah, but traffic is very interesting. We were beginning to wonder, I thought my driving was bad, like in this city. It has nothing to do with those taxi drivers up there. So definitely, I did not. It wasn't brave enough. Somebody, the Metro, was it? Somebody took it from the airport out to where we stayed, because we stayed at the JD Marriott there, right at the Capitol. So very, very nice hotel. Anywho, we're going to be looking at Elijah today, and just want to touch base on where we're gone, where we've been a little bit. You know, we're ending in the life of Ahab. Ahab is going to be passing on, and the reins passing on to his son. That's where we're going to pick up the lesson today. But before we do that, I wasn't sure where Chuck ended the lesson last week, so I just want to go back a bit and make sure we close out where what happens to Ahab with regards to his life with that. We know Ahab is a dolorous king with regards to his kingdom there. And it's an interesting quote that's in 1 Kings 21:25, where it talks about there was never anyone like Ahab who sold themselves to the evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by Jezebel, his wife. What a legacy there that, you know, being quoted there with regards to what Ahab's life represented. And I just thought that was very interesting because, you know, after all the struggles that he went through, all the things he went through with regards to his life with being an idolatrous and him trying to be encouraged to come back with Elijah, he still never followed or came back around with that piece of it. So very, very interesting with what his legacy is known for there. We'll soon learn that, you know, Ahab's life ends abruptly. It's a tragic death there with regards to it. And we'll see that, and we're going to pick up the story in 1 Kings 22 and 28 and read from there just to close out where Ahab is and what happened to Ahab with regards to being able to see that. But a very interesting life piece of it. I wanted to also point out, as Ahab's life ended tragically against the advice proven to Malachiah, Ahab went to war with Syria in hopes of capturing Ramoth of Galilee. Just want to point out where that is. You see where it's right under Israel with regards to the Sea of Galilee. That's where the war and the battle that's taking place here with regards to what's happening with Ahab and what happens to him in this battle. But that's a battle that's taking place that will take his life and end his life with regards to being able to see that. So we're going to pick up the story today on 1 Kings 22, 30, and read for a few verses here talking about the end of Ahab's life. So it picks up here that says, "The king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'I will enter the battle in disguise.'" So he's already entering the battle in disguise with regards to being able to see what's hidden here with, you know, him going into battle. So it's interesting on how he's going in. He's not going in as really to be seen as the king. He's going into the battlefield as a commoner or as a first line of defense in being able to fight off and going into that battle front. Picking up there, "I'll enter the battle in disguise, but you will wear my royal robes. So the king of Israel disguised himself and went into battle. Now the king of Aram had ordered the 32 chariot commander, do not fight with anyone small or great except the king of Israel. So they were looking for him in this battlefield. So that's, you know, it's very important to see that with regards to what's taking place here, is that they were looking for Ahab with regards to going into this battle. Then the chariot commanders saw Jehoshaphat. They thought, surely this is the king of Israel. So they turned to attack him. And when Jehoshaphat cried out, the chariot commander saw it was not the king of Israel, and they stopped pursuing him. Continuing on, it says, but someone drew a bow and randomly hit the king of Israel between the sections of his armor. The king told his chariot driver, wheel around and get me out of the fighting. I've been wounded. All day long, the battle raged, and the king was propped up in his chariot facing the Arameans. The blood from the wound ran down the floor of the chariot, and that evening he died. As the sun was setting, a cry spread through the army, every man to his town, every man to his land. So the king died and was brought to Samaria, and they buried him there. They washed the chariot in the pool of Samaria, where the prostitutes bathed, and the dogs licked up the blood, as the word of the Lord was declared. As for the other events of Ahab's reign, including all he did, the palace that he built and adorned with ivory, the cities he fortified, are all written in the book of the annals of the king of Israel. Ahab rested with his ancestry, and Ahazi, his son, succeeded him. So we can see here that this is where he's passing, and he's passing the torch to his son with regards to what's taking place there with the battlefield. But, you know, that's how he died tragically in this element there, and as we transition to his son taking over. And that's really where we're going to pick up our lesson this morning with regards to being able to see what takes place in the future here. All right. Well, I apologize. I thought I was reading and you were following along, but apparently not. All right. So let's pick up in 2 Kings. We're going into 2 Kings in the first chapter there. So if that's where you want to follow along is for us to be able to take our lesson text. So let's read this together. So after Ahab's death, Moab rebelled against Israel. Now, Ahaziah had fallen through the lattice of his upper room in Samaria and injured himself. So he sent messengers saying to them, go and consult Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, and see if I will recover from the injury. But the angel of the Lord said to Elijah the Tishbite, go up and meet the messenger of the king of Samaria and ask them, is it because there is no God in Israel that you are going off and to consult Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Therefore, this is what the Lord says. You will not leave your bed you are lying on. You will certainly die. So Elijah went. So we're able to see a couple things going on here with regards to what's taking place, what's staging the lesson of the day for us to be able to take advantage of and look at. And we'll see that the transition is taking place between Ahab dying off and his son taking the reign. And, you know, we'll see here is in that first verse, after Ahab's death, Moab rebels against Israel. And you see, Moab is down in the purple up here with regards to being able to see the kingdom of Israel. So there's quite a bit of distance in there that with regards to what's taking place there with what's happening with the raging of war. But I'm sure this is where they're taking advantage of the opportunity of them, the dad passing away, the opportunity of the transitioning of power that's taking place there with regards to being able to see that happen. Excuse me. So there's a transition of power, and I think Moab sees that as the opportunity to go and now and start attacking him and the kingdom there for them to get to break away from them. So it's interesting to see where it's one, it's where it's located, and two, the opportunity is there for them to be able to seize that time frame for them to be able to move on. So that's what's taking place here with the kingdom, and then we see what happened to Ahaziah with regards to being able to, that he's calling out. What happened to Ahaziah there? He fell through the lattice. Well, why would you be walking on the lattice or falling through the lattice? Anybody have? Chuck? Maybe he was celebrating, or maybe he, I often wonder if it's, I don't know how much time frame this is. Do you know how I couldn't find the timing between when Dad died, he took over, and then when this happened. It doesn't say. It's a very short reign is what my understanding is. So it's a very short amount of time that he's reigning here with regards to being able to do that. 2 years? So, you know, it's very short in his reign with regards to being able to see what takes place here. And again, there's no timing mentioned about how long that he, you know, took over, how long it was when he fell, and how long he lived after he fell, because according to this, he doesn't move or doesn't, he's bedridden with regards to being able to not be able to get out and about. So definitely we're being able to see that you know, what's taking place here with it. The book did imply that the lattice was there to help air flow through the palace or for it to be able to flow with air and cooling. And, you know, certainly wouldn't be something that you would be able to stand on or step on. It could have been anything, but it's severe enough that's caused him to fall and be injured enough that he is not going to recover. He is not going to be able to get up and walk with a limp or, you know, soreness or, you know, some type of element there. It is something that's causing him to be bedridden, according to the scripture. So that's important for us to be able to see here with regards to that. So we see they fell through the upper lattice in his upper room. You know, to whom did the king send messengers to ask whether he would recover? I mean, why would you think he would utilize, you know, the gods versus, you know, seeking, you know, God's help? Perfect. That's all you got to say. He's Dad's son. So he's going to follow after Dad's ways, right? He's going to, you know, that's what he's learned. That's what he's seen. That's what he's seen from his dad with regards to being able to do that. So that's a perfect illustration there that, you know, he's following in Dad's footsteps. Is what? Satan? Yep. Very interesting with that piece of it. Beelzebub, you know, does have some, you know, connotation about the New Testament. It's not the God that we should be worshiping. It's not the God that he needs to be focused in on with regards to being able to see where his life needs to be leading him. Who met the messengers of the king, and what message did he give to the king? Angel of the Lord, that's right, is what went to Elijah. Angel of the Lord went to Elijah to tell him to move, but the messengers were sent and being able to send the message there. The kings certainly lacked the trust and faith in God, resulting in the coming of the angel of Yahweh to Elijah. So the angel appears to Elijah to do what? To move, to be sent. And again, what I like about this too is we see Elijah, when he's called upon, he goes. And that's an important piece for us, as you know, in our walk is, you know, when we hear what we think we need to be doing, we need to be going. And that's one of the messages here that we can see in Elijah's life is that when he was called, he went. He didn't wait. He didn't try to hem-haul it around. He didn't do some of the other characters that we have in the Bible that talks about, well, I'm not going to go, I don't want to go, or I can't speak, or any of the excuses. You see Elijah getting up and moving and wanting to move and doing what God is telling him to do through that angel. Correct. Correct. It goes back to, like, you know, the golden image of, you know, the old, of the, in their view, that's what they were, but they have had enough examples, enough, you know, what's been shared with them that it isn't the true God, the true and living God that they need to be worshiping. And that's really the point here with regards to being able to look at that is, you know, who is it that they're worshiping? And if it's a false God that can't do anything for them, and that's really the message here is that it, they cannot, that God cannot do anything for him. Susan? Poor choices. That's a good, there's consequences that always follow those choices. And that's something that we'll learn in, we learn in life quickly that there's a lots of consequences. Certainly, they replace the God that has no power. Let's not forget, there's no power in those gods that they're calling their gods or worshiping. So very important piece there that there's no saving grace. Or just like the examples that Ahab had had prior to with at Mount Carmel, you know, pour water on the altar, pour more water on the water altar, pour more water, and you know, their God, call upon your gods, and nothing took place. And it wasn't until they called upon the true and living God that they, you know, that altar was consumed and all that took place. So definitely the power of God in making sure we're worshiping the correct God is very important. The message that Elijah delivered is, you know, he's rebuking the king. You know, that's one of the things that we need to see here is that, you know, Elijah was coming to rebuke the king that there's no God in Israel. Why are you calling upon this Beelzebub of Ekron? And being able to see that. So that's one of the important pieces here is, you know, Elijah's been sent to help him see his error of his ways with regards to that piece. And then he tells him, oh, by the way, you're going to die. You're not going to recover. You're not going to be able to be healed from this injury and that you are going to die from it. And that was the message that he provided. Chuck? Yeah, I don't know. We don't know. But certainly, that's the indication of what's taking place there with regards to being able to see that, and certainly his actions reflect that there is no focal point on worshiping God. You know, he's turning to the idolatry of worship with regards to that piece, and certainly that is where he's, you know, where he's at. It could be his mother's influence. I mean, the other piece of it is his mother's influence on Ahab was strong enough to pull Ahab way over to the far side. And even going back to that first verse that we shared earlier with, you know, it talked about Ahab's wife's influence on him with regards to being an idol worshiper. So, mom's still alive. Okay. So, I'm sure she has a interest and a say of what he's doing. So certainly that's taking place here with regards to being able to focus with that. All right, so let's look at what happens next, because, you know, when there's fire, that's always a good time for a Bible study. So, you know, fire and destruction. So in verses 5 and 8, we'll look through that real quick because it talks about what happens next. And the messengers returned to the king. He asked them, "Why have you come back?" That's interesting. Why is he asking that already? "A man came to meet us," they replied, "and he said to us, 'Go back to the king and who sent you and tell him, this is what the Lord says. It's because there is no God in Israel that you are sending messengers to consult Beelzebub, the god of Ekron. Therefore, you will not leave your bed you are lying on. You will certainly die. The king asked them, what kind of man was it who came to meet you and told you this? They replied, he had a garment of hair and had a leather belt around his waist. The king said, it was Elijah the Tishbite. It does, doesn't it? It's what I thought about when I read it there. What was the king's response when the messengers returned? Because I think it's very interesting how quickly he asked that. You know, who came? But more important, go back to the first verse there. He talks about how quickly the king wanted to know why they'd come back. And I don't know if he was expecting them to come back at a later time, or he was going to take longer to find out, or I don't know the delay there, but certainly there was some type of questioning, why have you all returned? Did you?
Yeah, it wasn't enough time to get that problem back.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about that. The timing that it would have took for them to travel there, that's a good point there with regards to being able to see that piece with regards to it. So he may have knew that there hadn't been enough time that passed for them to be already back in there saying, you're going to die. I mean, you're not going to make it for it. So interesting point there with regards to the timing that it may have took for them to travel, and he knew that it would have been a short time, shorter than he expected them to arrive back. How did the messenger describe the prophet he met? And it goes back to what Clayton said earlier. He was dressed in what?
You
know, a furry outfit and a big belt. So, yes, it leads us to believe, like with John the Baptist, you know, there is some type of the text that accommodates the lesson indicated that it may have been the dress attire for prophets. I don't know. That's the first I've heard of that with regards to it being a hairy garment with a belt, but certainly it goes in line with John the Baptist on his proclamation of coming forward before Christ. So very possibly it could be the prophet's choice of clothing. He knew it was Elijah. Chuck? Right. Goat hair for cashmere? I don't even know. I'm sure probably the wilderness living or the outside elements, I'm sure it was probably something of warmth and something, you know, comfortable that they would be able to have, because I don't think they knew where they were heading next. I mean, as a prophet, you know, they were listening to God to lead them, and I don't know that they were focusing on the material pieces of it with, you know, homes and having the comfort of home and those types of things. So certainly it certainly warrants our interest in hearing about John the Baptist, what he wore, and now seeing what Elijah is wearing and how that relates for us to be able to look at that. You know, the king knew him pretty regularly, right? I mean, when you see there that he didn't, all he had to do is describe him, and he knew it was Elijah. So it must have been something with that coat of many colors or something there with regards to being able to show him with regards to what's taking place there in his attire. But certainly, without hesitation, the king knew that he was describing him, and he knew it was Elijah that they had came in contact with the messengers that he had sent with regards to having that interference there. So certainly he knew of Elijah. And that's another point that I want to make too, is that I don't know where he was in his realm of thinking there, but certainly he knew who Elijah was, which indicates this with the text here, is that he knew of Elijah, he knew about Elijah, a man, a prophet of God, so you question, you know, the idolatry worship and knowing Elijah the prophet. So certainly that's a sign there for us to look at. All right, this is where the fire comes down. This is the good stuff. All right, verses 9 and 10 we'll look at, and then we'll read a couple more verses. And in verse 9 it says, "And then he sent Elijah to the captain with his company of 50. The captain went up to Elijah, who was sitting on top of the hill, and said to him, 'Man of God, the king says, come down.' Elijah answered to the captain, 'If I'm a man of God, may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men.' And fire fell from heaven and consumed the captain and the men." Reading on 11 and 12, it talks about, at this time, the king sent Elijah another captain of 50 men. The captain said to him, "Man of God, this is what the king says, come down at once." "If I am a man of God," Elijah replied, "may fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50 men." And the fire of God fell from heaven and consumed him and his 50 men. So the king sent a third captain with his 50 men. I don't know how he got another 50 men to go in a burnt field there. But he sent another captain of 50 men. The third captain went up and fell on his knees before Elijah. "Man of God," he begged, "please have respect for my life and the lives of these 50 men, your servants. See, fire has fallen from heaven and consumed the first two captains and all their men. But now have respect for my life." So, you know, three sets of groups that went, 150 people have gone up to be able to meet with Elijah there with regards to taking place there, and 100 of them are already zapped with fire. Huh? 102, excuse me, yes. Don't forget the captain there, yes. 102 men, right off the bat. Huh? I see that you're on it this morning, that's good. We might have you help us count contribution this morning. But certainly see that, you know, what's happening here with regards to being able to look at this. What did the king do to the prophet there? What did the king seek to do with the prophet there? What do you think he was calling up to grab Elijah for? I mean, is it really the question that I'm asked there? Yes. I think he wanted to kill him and take him out. I mean, I don't think he was looking to say, "How are you doing?" and, you know, have lunch with him or anything. Could be. Maybe he was looking for the prophet to save his life. Then he knew that it was. Well, he had already got the message back. He was going to die. So maybe this was a plea for his life. It could have been where he wanted to just have conversation with him with regards to that and seek a way to be able to help him in being able to do that. But we see Elijah sitting on top of a hill, and the captains have been told. To go up to Elijah and get him and bring him to me. What's interesting here too is, how did the captains address Elijah? Well, the third one did that, but the other one said they did call him man of God. They were focused in on being able to see that, recognize him as a man of God. So the captains did make mention of that with regards to being able to see them and go up to them and be able to be a part of that discussion with them. But they seemed to address him with reverence as they came before him with regards to being able to do. And I'm sure the second set of captains had more reverence than the first captains, and the third captain had more reverence for him, as we see with what took place with regards to him falling on his knees and begging for his life. How many times did the king of Israel send a captain of 50? We've already talked about the presence of Elijah. We see that there was three sets of captains being sent up there to them to be able to talk with him of 50. So we see, have already seen that. What was the difference between the first two times and the third time of the captains going up? There we go, arrogance versus humility. We see a major change take place there. I saw and read Susan's Live, the fear that took place and being able to see what happened with those guys. Correct. Only the third one fell to his knees and begged. It also talks about him begging for his life, or and his 50 men's life, because he's already seen what has taken place with regards to being able to see what took hold there. But interesting enough that, you know, one, they see that he's a man of God, and secondly, we see a difference taking place on as a pursuit proceed to the third one going up with regards to being able to see how they're addressing them going forward. So we see that he's begging, knees begging. All right. So let's look at the last portion of our lesson text this morning. He asked him to come down. Was the first one come down at once? Was the second comment back from the second set of guys going up there? And then with humility, there was going up there because of what they've seen, what they've experienced. You know, certainly that certainly would have resonated big time with regards to what took place with what happened there and the power of God. I mean, just him being able to call down, power and the fire coming down to consume them. I mean, can you imagine what that must have looked like with regards to being able to see what took place there? But definitely, you know, the power of God being fully seen with regards to taking place. All right. All right, the last few verses here, it talks about in 15 through 18, it says, "The angel of the Lord said to Elijah, 'Go down with him, do not be afraid of him.' So Elijah got up and went down with him to the king. He told the king, 'This is what the Lord says. It's because there is no God in Israel that you have consulted, that you have sent messengers to consult Beelzebub, the god of Ekron. Because you have done this, you will never leave the bed you are lying on. You will certainly die.' So he died according to the word of the Lord, and Elijah had spoken, because Elzerad and his son Joram succeeded him as king in the second year of Jeroram, son of Josaphat, king of Judah." Whew. So as all the other events of, as I can't say it now, Ahazar's reign, that and what he did are not written in the books of the annals of the king of the Israel. So we can see what, you know, what ultimately happened to Ahaz, I can't say it now. To the king, and I practiced that all day yesterday. Ahasuerus, nope. Ultimately, what happened to the king? I mean, he died. He never recovered from the fall. His life was ended. You know, as Chuck mentioned earlier, he reigned for only for a short amount of time, for about 2 years, and there's not a whole lot of anything that we know more about him than that. With regards to what took place. But certainly there's a sign for us to be able to see, you know, where. Exactly. It's so short-lived that there's nothing in the book there for them to record other than, you know, them moving on. You know, how do we apply that today for us today? You know, certainly, you know, there's good lessons in it for us with regards to it. A couple of things the book pulled out is, you know, when individuals find themselves in time of trial, they often look for help. Like the king, individuals sometimes turn to the wrong sources. Let us always turn to God and rely on the help that God provides. You know, sometimes when times of struggles, we're always trying to fix it ourselves, or we're trying to rely on somebody else. It's a great example for us to be able to see that we need to be turning and relying on God to help us through life, in good times, in bad times, in times of troubles, all those things that we need to be focusing in turning our life back to God and helping, allowing God to work in our lives to be able to make us the betterment of us to be able to move forward. So, you know, that's something we all need to hold true to, because, you know, we live in a society where weakness is not good. Weakness is a sign of that you're not strong enough, and, you know, we need to make sure that we're relying on God for providing for our every need. You know, God knows our needs long before we ask for them. He knows the number of hairs on our head. You know, He feeds the birds of the air. God will take care of us. We need to rely on God for us to be able to see where He leads us, guides us, and watches over us. But that's an important lesson for us today, is to making sure that we look to God for help. Also, the second point of the lesson today is, you know, that God teaches us not to ignore or replace Him. You know, not to be looking for another idol or another thing for us to be able to take place, and that prevents us from worshiping God or focusing on God or trying to live a life that's calling upon Him and relying on Him. So we need to make sure that we're not ignoring or we're finding replacements. Sometimes TV can be a distraction. Sometimes other things can be a distraction from things that we need to be and be focused in on and worshiping God. So it's very important for us to make sure that we're not allowing things to take ownership of what we should or shouldn't be doing for the cause of Christ. In Exodus 20, verses 2 and 3, I am the Lord of God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And it just goes back to that we need to make sure we're not allowing things to consume us with regards to being able to look at that. With that, that's going to be our close of our lesson today. Anybody have any comments, any additional comments? We appreciate you being here for class. Next week, we're going to look at 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 1 through 8 for the class next week. So thank you very much. Appreciate your comments this morning.